We kick off with a special episode of the self-hosted program. Alex is out on assignment at All Things Open this week, but both Brent and Jeff are in studio because we're getting ready for Linux Fest. Welcome into the self-hosted show, guys.
Well, thank you.
Hello.
Thank you for being here. Audience, you probably remember listener Jeff. He's helped us with lots of projects over the years. And Brent, you were just here like the last episode or something like that.
No, it's funny. Last episode we said, oh, you haven't been here in like 6 months. Here I am.
And when Jeff and Brent are here, that means it's project time.
It's on.
And it has been on like crazy. We have been knocking off some projects that have been on lists for a couple of years. And this week, I think the one that I'm most excited about is we have my water heater, which is both gas and electric, both sides of it, and the water pump are now all on relays attached to an ESP device, which of course is communicating with Home Assistant, so I can now automate my water pump and my water heater. I've wanted that for so, so long. And Jeff came over, he brought like boxes of stuff. And I thought, well, he doesn't need to bring anything. I got a ton of stuff. But I think we ended up putting all your stuff in the wall.
Mainly because I know where it's at, you know, what I have and how it works.
Did you, Chris, have a look at his trunk? It's
it's like a Radio Shack went out of business and he pulled up and just opened up trunk, you know?
Give it all to me.
It's so precise.
When you're operating in an RV, things are never as simple as they should be. So, of course, we crack this central panel open that has all these switches and it has status lights for tank fill and you can start the generators, kind of like the central control panel of the RV. And this is where we want to, in line, install the relays so we can control the pumps and the water heaters. How hard could that be to find a negative? You know, this panel full of wires. I mean, 50, 60 different wires in there at least. So, bundles. And Jeff, how hard was it to find ground?
Well, we assumed the one we had would work, and it didn't. We tried the thermostat and ended up turning on the furnace.
Yeah, it uses negative for signaling.
Yeah.
And when you cut the negative, the furnace turns on.
Or just put a load on it. Yeah, it freaked out about that. And that was after we already had it all buttoned up and thinking, yeah, this is the right way to go. It's tested. It works. No. Yeah.
Yeah.
That feels so confusing to me. Like, why is that the choice that they made? Surely that's not a standard, right?
It's one less wire they had to run.
That's exactly it. And, you know, they're running it across the RV. I don't know. But there is also a little LCD panel on there that shows you the run time of the generator. You know, that's how you kind of keep track of your generators, the hours it runs. And Jeff was looking at that. And we'd mentioned it at one point, but I think maybe we dismissed it for some reason or another. I don't remember.
I was more worried that we'd turn something else on unintentionally.
Yeah. I had to run around and, like, physically disable my slides because we'd kept setting the panel down on the counter, which would then push the buttons for the slides and the slides would start coming in while we're working.
No.
So like, hold on, I'll go unplug them. So there was a little bit of, you know, we're working on a live system here. But honestly, once you found the ground, the rest was really simple. It's ESP home on these little devices, standard little relay that you can get off of Amazon. We'll have some links in the show notes. And then Home Assistant discovers it and the relay shows up as a switch to Home Assistant, so I can just toggle that relay. And I'm toggling the water heater. I'm toggling the water pump on and off. I've wanted it for so long.
Now, Jeff, I think you learned a few things during this project, right?
Yeah, a few words of caution when dealing with relays and these ESP boards. We're using like a D1 mini or a clone of it. It's all the same thing. You can use a Node MCU, just about any of those boards. Make sure you look at the board you're using and find its pinout. And there are certain pins that you're not supposed to use relays on. When it gets power, it might hammer it and not actually close or open, just sits there and vibrates. And that's something in the past that tripped me up for quite a while. But these little devices can have numerous relays. I believe the D1 Mini was 4 or 5. We're using 3, and all 3 of them are just fine. They're 5-volt relays, and they're all taking power through the D1 even. So we'll see how long that lasts, but it should be okay.
We were thinking, like, we want to build this in a way that is repairable. So if a component fails, we can kind of just unplug the relay in the ESP home and just plug the standard switch back in. And then things just go back to the way they were before we did anything. That, though, is less of my concern. Because what I feel like I have learned over the last few years of when I first started trying smart home automation, and all that was really available was like the Hughes products and the really expensive commercial products. I don't know if I've ever had a single one that doesn't eventually die on me. They die out, they burn out, and then you end up having this $300 piece of lighting equipment that is entirely proprietary. And what I'm kind of coming around to, especially with these relays and whatnot, is all of them are modular. The relay can be replaced. The ESP home can be replaced. The power supply can be replaced. And they can just be swapped out with standard stuff that it's documented everywhere. And I'm a lot more comfortable building that into the wall than I would be like a TP-Link smart switch or a Hughes light dimmer or something. I just would not ever want to build that into the wall and then seal it. But with something like an ESP, and especially since ESP Home is so easy to manage with Home Assistant, it's a different kind of it's not reliability. What would you call that?
Not worried about the obsolescence issue either.
Yeah. Right? It's not going to, like, in 5 years, I'm not going to be able to log into the app to update the app or update the firmware or something.
Now, I think it was like a year or two ago, I was at Alex's place and he had me do something similar with Shelly's, throw a bunch of them in behind switches and things like that. Why not use those? Because I know those are pretty well built and they're well tested and all that.
The Shelly's, I believe, are all using 120 volt AC. So they're meant for residential wiring, right?
I think they might have one or two that's DC, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely an option, right? I like them. In fact, some of them even have some features these don't have, like power monitoring built in and whatnot.
I guess one downside, they throw up their own Wi-Fi AP, right?
There's that. I think you can flash them, but there's that. But the other thing is a four-pack of these is like, you know, nothing. It's the pricing is such that you can bang out a whole bunch of them. Yeah, a three-pack is $16.99.
And have spares on site, too.
Yeah, you can have – and so that's really nice. And then there's a good community around the ESP Home stuff, too. So I like that a lot, and I think the integration there is a little tighter with Home Assistant. And if you're thinking about something, I'm going to need a firmware update for 10 years or some 5 years or whatever, I think I prefer that route, the community open source route with the ESP Home stuff. But I think the Shelly's are good devices. Do you have a strong preference yourself, Jeff?
I haven't played with the Shelly's at all, and – funny enough, Alex is actually the one to introduce me to ESP Home and help me through it, because my thinking with these ESP boards was I need to get a binary and flash it with PyFlasher. Like there's a, you know, ESP board flasher for Linux and or for anything. And that was my first thinking. I couldn't find a binary anywhere. I'm looking everywhere. Like, where's the ESP Home binary? I just couldn't find it. And I'm going through the documentation, realizing that everybody's compiling it. And I've had issues with that before. And eventually he's like, no, dummy, do it through Home Assistant. What do you mean? He's put the add-on in Home Assistant, plug the dang thing in, and follow the instructions. And eventually, it finally clicked in my dumb brain. And it is really that simple. You plug it into either your host laptop that you're on or the Home Assistant machine, which is a little bit easier, and you just follow the instructions. It'll write a full config that works with ESP Home standard, and then you can edit that YAML config to what you want to use it for.
Yeah, you could tweak device name or add additional relays like we did with switch names, and then you can name the individual relays in the YAML. It's all really easy to read. It's the first time I'd ever done it, and it all made sense to me.
So now you may both have different answers to this question, but I'm curious what you think it was the most challenging part of this project in particular.
It's always the little things, right? Like trying to figure out where to pull ground from, how to get them installed where they don't block the wiring, or you know, getting these screws in this one spot. Don't you feel like it's always the little things?
Yeah, it's the addition of everything together, the small things together. You know, the ground issue we brought up, and we tried running wire from one side of the wall to the other through the crevices. That didn't work. I mean, just all sorts of little stuff like that. There's also a bit of a tedium when building these, a lot of small solder joints. You know, we're working one ESP with three relays. That's 3 5 volts, three grounds, three data transfer, and then making all the connectors for it to be compatible with the original switches as well. That's a separate thing. So I don't want everything screwed in the screw terminals because they're quite terrible. I wanted everything soldered, but I also wanted them to be easily disconnected. So we're using the same quick disconnects you'd find in anything automotive, including these RV switches. All that together, it's fun for me. So it's not really a hard thing, but it's a tedium. And then you have to decide ahead of time what your plan is. You know, I've never used more than one relay on these ESP boards. I wasn't certain it was possible. You see those relay boards with multiple relays on them, but they usually, or not, I don't know about usually, but the ones I've seen with, say, 10 relays on them, they do it through I2 squared. I've never touched that stuff or whatever that protocol is called. I've never used that stuff before. I've never used that protocol. This, you know, it's still learning for me too. So a little bit of extra research, of course, scope creep, you know, oh, well, we're doing the one, we got to do the other one as well. And what about the water pump? You know, yeah. We're adding,
yeah.
Which is fine. Yeah. And that's always fun to learn. But
well, in reality, it starts with this button broke. We should fix this button.
Yeah.
And then it goes to, well, if we're going to fix the button, we might as well hook it up to a relay.
We might as well upgrade it.
Yeah, and make it better. And then it's like, well, if we're going to hook up the electric side to a relay, we got to hook up the gas side. And if we're going to hook up the heater, we got to have the pump.
Yeah.
It starts with, let's fix this button.
Yeah, and literally the physical button is broken. That's something else we did, right? We had to figure out how to pop those buttons out and or the switches out and repair those. Yeah,
there was a repair function we were doing too.
Yeah, yeah. It's all just, it all kind of adds up, but it's fun. I mean,
I look at it as I've tried to look at when things break or, you know, die and need replaced. I try to look at it as an opportunity to replace it and build it back better with something that is open. You know, I'm big about building back better and open. Well, back on the show, and it's been forever since Paulus and I chatted. I don't know if you remember, Paulus, but I think it was still just the first year of Home Assistant. You and I had a little video chat a while ago. So it's been way overdue. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, there is so much to get into this week. Some of the stuff I'm most excited about this year, actually. But I wanted to start with something that caught our co-host Alex's attention, and that was the sort of immediate, abrupt news about Mazda going after a library, I think, if I have this right, a library dev, that unfortunately resulted in also the integration for the Mazda Connected Services and Home Assistant having to get removed. And it's sort of just this heavy-handed, it feels like, strongman tactic that really has me thinking about ownership and what we have rights to. It's our own cars. And so, Paulus, I know Home Assistant had to make some news on the blog. You made a blog post on October 13th. Can you kind of fill us in a little bit?
Yeah, so what happened is that a person in our community who maintained a library to interact with Mazda, he got a DMCA takedown from GitHub got a DMCA takedown claiming that he had violated copyright.
I see. So Mazda's lawyers went to GitHub.
Yes. So, two things. So they went to GitHub and said his Python library violated copyright of both the iOS app and the Android app. And they also sent him a cease and desist letter saying he has to stop abruptly like all his activities related to like integrating Mazda stuff. And he was also the maintainer of the Mazda integration in Home Assistant, and the Mazda integration in Home Assistant used his library as well.
I see.
And so, you know, for him, like, this is just, you know, a person in his spare time working on this. Like, he obviously owns a Mazda car. So that's why he was invested in this and, like, building this. And he was like, yeah, didn't sign up for this, right?
I don't want this trouble.
Yeah. And so, yeah, he came to us and we're like, yeah, let's just delete it because, you know, we've seen it in the past. Like, you know, this is a very blunt tactic. Like, I wish they wouldn't have just sent us an email, right? Then we can, like, talk about things. But the intention is clear, right? They don't want to be integrated in Home Assistant and there are many ways to block users.
Why do you suspect that would be? It doesn't make sense to me because it seems like it just results in dissatisfied customers. And it's not like it's costing them anything, is it?
It costs them in that they have a cloud service and sure. Like they get more API calls, right? So, but at the Mazda integration had in analytics 227 users, which analytics is opt-in, right? With Home Assistant and it's around one third opt-in. So let's say it's like 750 people were talking to Mazda servers.
Yeah.
I doubt that showed up, right? Like,
and if it did, they need to build a better infrastructure.
Yes.
Because if they sell too many more cars, they're going to be in a problem. Yeah,
yeah.
I struggle to understand it other than it's like they just want to have their own service, maybe their own app, and they don't want anybody going anywhere else. Do you think that could be a component? It's just
I think it's about, yeah, controlling what users can do and controlling the experience. And
yeah.
I think this is interesting because this kind of gets into, for example, why some manufacturers are not happy about Matter. It's about owning the user experience, right? Like you open the Mazda app and they can upsell you, I don't know, new tires, for example. You open the Home Assistant app, we're never going to sell Mazda tires.
One question I have around there is, you know, this feels like a bit of a dirty tactic, as you alluded to. If this worked so easily on this project, do you think they'll just be encouraged to do it elsewhere? And so how do we, as, you know, open source software creators and just a huge community, deal with that? Because it seems, I don't know, like a real problem.
I think the bigger thing here is that we shouldn't buy those products, right? Like, in the end, a company, one way or the other, can lock people out of their own data. And the best way to work around it is to make sure you buy products where that's not possible, right? So anything with an open standard or anything that can talk locally can just work. Like Zigbee, Z-Wave, or Matter device, they can never take away from you, right? There's just no cloud necessary. There's no ping back home necessary to set it up. It just works. You have also like non-open standards, like, you know, you have those Shelly relays, they open an access point, right? And locally you connect to it, you set it up. There's also no cloud necessary to configure. And those companies can, you know, once you have that product, you can do whatever you want with it.
The car is maybe a problem for the future, but you guys have made incredible progress this year on solving this problem for the voice assistants. And it's been the year of voice. And we've been watching Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 come out and Chapter 3. And now in October, we've got Chapter 4, Wake Words. The big one. I have to imagine this was what everybody was asking for from the very beginning.
Yeah. So, you know, we did Chapter 1 in January. And, you know, we started like, we called it, was like the we were reading the book backwards, right? So we started with just intent recognition without even dealing with speech or wake words. Just intent recognition, because you kind of built everything on top of that. And since January, people are like, where's wake word? Like, how can this ever replace my Google if there's no wake word? And it's not that we didn't know. It's just that, like, no, all these different pieces have to be in place. Like, a voice assistant is a very complicated stack, right? Like, it's all these different parts, and everything has to work well enough. Otherwise, the chain falls apart.
Yeah, from connectivity to room quality and audio quality. And so I'm really, really impressed with what is version one, or if you'll even call it that, seems to be. And can you kind of describe the stack? Because the way I break it down, Paul, is what we're really looking at now is three incredible open source projects that are coming out of Nebukasa. Piper, we have the Open Whisper, well, actually four if you consider the Wyoming protocol, and now we have Open Wake Word, right? So in my world, I see these as three containers that I can run on my system that now give me the capability to do local text-to-voice and voice-to-text and speech recognition. It's a pretty incredible stack.
Yes. Yeah, and this is actually how we've always envisioned it, right? Like, I mean, Home Assistant is about choice. And so we've been building it up to make sure that through the Wyoming protocol, which is really the piece that unlocks it all, which is an open protocol for integrating voice assistant pieces into like a bigger voice assistant stack. And so, you know, the Home Assistant box itself might not be the most powerful, and people are running Open Whisper on it, the speech to text. People are running Piper on it. Whisper is not so good on a Raspberry Pi. It takes too long to really transcribe. Piper is good enough because we cache all the outputs that it generates. So the first time it's slow, afterwards it's fast. But because of Wyoming, it doesn't have to run on Home Assistant, right? You have a bigger server. It can just run over there. You're subscribed to Home Assistant Cloud. It can also run in the cloud. You don't even have to run it locally if you want to. And it really allows for choice. And I think what is more important for us is it allows for experimentation. So open source people are always tinkering with stuff, right? Like, Home Assistant didn't just start, like, it was because I was tinkering with something and it kind of grew into something. And the same with every other open source project. So allowing people to easily tinker with text-to-speech or speech-to-text or wake words and seeing how that fits into a whole voice assistant, that's now super easy. And that will hopefully result in even more and better projects that we can all leverage.
Well, I definitely see the wheel spinning already, because what I think is pretty fantastic here is with Wyoming, I can run components individually. So in my example, my home system runs off of a Yellow, but I also have an Odroid that I run the more processor intensive stuff on. and it just connects over Wyoming, and it's wicked fast. But I actually got started by using the built-in Nebucasa service stuff just to experiment to see if it was worth playing with. And that's, you know, that took 10 seconds to set up, and it's really good. So that, I mean, a lot of people would be happy with just that, I think. What's the privacy story there?
So the privacy story there is that this kind of, there's two different types of clouds, more or less, right? You have an IoT specific cloud where every data you upload is tied to your user account, tied to your devices and states and these kind of things. And then you have the more like service oriented cloud, like just pure AWS, pure Azure, pure Google Cloud. And our voice APIs in the Nebucasa offers, they're not tied to a user. They are tied to like the authentication token, and it's not connected to a user account. We don't store that data. Azure doesn't store that data. It's just giving you the text back. It doesn't go through Home Assistant Cloud. Like your Home Assistant instance is talking directly to Azure, and it's not tied to your home or identity in any way. So it doesn't like... You're not going to see Facebook ads, right?
Right,
because you
right.
asked about like
yeah.
whatever.
So it's significantly better than compared to, say, using an Echo or the Google Home Assistant. Yeah.
Yeah, because if you look at Echo or Google, you could go into the history. You can actually see, you know, they will tell you all the things you've told them, and they will show it to you in context of your home, right? So it's like, oh, yeah, they have made that link directly. That's the goal.
Yeah.
They're not even hiding it anymore.
Yeah, I remember when I first tried the Echo, you could even go back and I don't know if they still do this, but you could play the clip.
Yeah.
Okay, so one of the things, obviously, that is really exciting about an open project like this is people will be able to set their own wake words. You come with a bunch of presets. Like I think the OK Nabu is a good one just because that's probably not a very common phrase. Hey Jarvis is also kind of fun in there. But, you know, pause. Everybody wants to make their own wake words. And I did play around with the collab book that you guys link in the blog post. But, you know, when I crank it up, it doesn't really want to play along. What are sort of the future plans there, if any, to make it approachable for people to create their own wake words, maybe even through the Home Assistant UI one day or something like that?
So the... Right now, it requires quite a lot of training. The notebook that we put out, like at the bottom, you can change some of the parameters. And the reason that it like it really creates a basic wake word. The wake words you create with that Colab notebook are using the same pipeline as you know, the open wake word pipeline. I'm not sure if we I can explain how it works. Where like it uses a base model from Google. It uses Piper to generate a lot of different sentences based on different speakers. And then it is able to mix speakers to create new kind of like sounding voices. So we can generate like 20, 30,000 samples of saying the wake word that you want to use.
And also you inject different types of background noise too. I saw it pulling down FLAX of different kind of noise environments.
Yes. So we do noise environments, and we also mutate the sound so that like close to the microphone, far away from the microphone, these kind of things. And then we fine tune that model to detect, you know, that wake word. And the last step is that we run it against a negative sample. So there's like podcast databases out there, and you just basically play all that podcast to the model and say, this is not the wake word, this is not the wake word, this is not the wake word.
That's great.
No way.
And that's like, you know, you put 2,000 hours of podcast against it, and it's actually like, you know, it really helps the model learn the wake word even better. And so the Colab notebook that we made available, we kind of limited all those steps just so that it fits within the free compute that Google offers.
Right. Which is limited. And it almost made me want to go sign up and see if I could put it in a much more powerful machine. Because I just wanted to crank it.
Yeah, but you can run all of this at home, right? Even on a desktop computer.
To a degree. I did give it a go. We got close, Paulus. We got close to getting the whole Python environment working, but I don't think we got it at 100%.
That's the problem, right? Like setting up like these scientific environments, they're very particular about all the versioning. We've been looking into a Docker container, but then you need like GPU pass through and these kind of things for training. And that's just, there needs to be a better way. But there is actually already one kind of shortcut that we can take that Open Wake Word supports, but that Home Assistant doesn't support. And it's called, actually, I'm not sure how it's called, but it's fine tuning with voice samples recorded by the voice satellite who is going to feed audio into the model. So by you talking to your microphone that is the one in your RV, for example, it will learn about the room, and basically you say it three times or four times, and the model can get really tailored to your voice.
That's
and
so neat. Microphone. Right, like some real-world training right then and there.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
That part we're going to bring to Home Assistant, right? So that is like a small step, which should help with like the training.
It sounded like you're both very happy with some of the results, but it sounded like there was also some areas you already know you want to improve upon in the pipeline or maybe in the recognition.
Yeah, what you know, we really like Open Wake Word, but it's based on this model by Google, and this is actually really necessary because speech to text is hard, and to create a proper speech to text model, you need to basically have a lot of input data. You need like Google scale of data, right? So the fact that Google put this model out open source is great because they have trained it on whatever input they have access to, which is a lot. However, Google's model doesn't run on an ESP32, and that's why we have to run it inside Home Assistant or, you know, with Wyoming on another server. But it means for the user experience, if they add like multiple voice satellites, I think the limit is 5 right now for a Raspberry Pi 4, you're going to max out whatever your Raspberry Pi 4 can do, right? So we really would love for the wake word detection and some of the audio cleanup all to happen on the ESP32, where it doesn't, that means that you can just scale up. Like if you have like, I don't know, you want one in every bedroom, bathroom, living room, kitchen, like you might end up with like 8 voice satellites and it shouldn't impact how Home Assistant runs.
Yes, that would be really nice because I'm going to be that guy. I am. I'm going to have them outside. I'm going to have them everywhere.
Yeah. Well, so the cool thing is that right now with presence sensors, you could disable wake word listening if you're not in that room to make sure that nobody is, it doesn't overload the system.
That's a great idea. Yes. Okay. That'll be my little hack that I'll use until we get that sorted out. I kind of also, though, do like the satellite streaming model. I see what you're saying, and the advantages of local processing do sound really good, but the benefits of the streaming model that we have now is it means the satellite requirement is basically nothing. And
yeah,
that gives me a lot of options in terms of like building little custom rigs. I don't know if that's really going to happen, but it feels like I have a lot more options when the satellite's just kind of a dumb stream.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I don't know if you saw the video of Paul who made that robot from Star Wars that is now a voice assistant. Like, that wouldn't have been possible if he also, besides having to learn how to 3D print and servo move robots around, also had to build a voice assistant into that, right? So, yeah, it really, in that part, I agree. The challenge there is that not every microphone is the same. So Espressif has made some the ESP32 S3 box available, which has 2 microphones, and they made algorithms available to do like blind source separation, acoustic echo cancellation, a bunch of these cleanup things.
And that is happening on device, right?
Yes, that would happen on device.
Yeah, that does look like that seems like that's the box I want to really go in on, I think, when it becomes generally available.
Yeah. So that's their next target, I would say also, right? Like, is to get that box. Eventually, we want to build our own hardware. We want to, because that box doesn't look nice, right? It looks still too geeky. Like, you know, we think about the home approval factor, right? Like, hey, you want to put this in your living room. And like right now, I just have a cord dangling with an Atom Echo at the end of the cord in my living room.
Yeah. Yep.
And that, you know, it needs to look nice. It needs to fit in with the decor and these kind of things. So we want to build some hardware that really blends in. But I think we want to have on-device wake word ready for that. The bigger challenge will be, can we get custom wake words running on that device?
Yeah, that would be pretty great. Okay, so here's my last kind of your voice question. As I'm looking at the broader open source ecosystem, of course, I'm a longtime Linux desktop user. I'm very, very excited by the projects that have come out of the Ear Voice because they are not necessarily dependent on Home Assistant. They can just run on Linux, and I think there's a lot of possibilities there. Have you seen any other projects looking at this work, at using some of this work in some of their projects?
Yeah, especially around Piper. Piper has seen a lot of uptick because Piper is a neural network, you have to be optimized to run on a Raspberry Pi 4, which means that if you run it on a Linux desktop with like an Intel processor, it's going to run fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a bunch of screen readers that have adopted Piper now, so that they, because, you know, if you're on a screen reader and you want to quickly skip through every button, right? So you're like pressing, read the next part, read the next part, like, you know, for blind people to navigate. And Piper can just keep up, right? Like Piper is really useful there. We also see that there was this, the National University of Uzbekistan. No, was it Kazakhstan? I think it was Kazakhstan. They are using Piper to in their scientific research because there are not a lot of models trained for their language, and they were able to train their own models themselves.
Fantastic.
Because it's all open.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And at some point there was also, we lost track of that person, but he was using Piper to get books, I think in the Philippines, like turned into audiobooks so that like more, he could easily distribute like to rural areas, like more books. So, you know, it's, once you start doing it, I think somebody made a Unity plugin as well so that your NPCs can all have like unique voices. You know, it can be used for everything, really.
I'm excited to maybe see even somebody take a stab at some sort of Linux desktop assistant or something.
Yeah, I mean, it should be fairly easy because you can use all our different parts. It's just the sentence processing you would have to do for Linux specific.
Okay, so I want to shift gears a little bit because by around the time, it'll be late this week, Friday morning-ish, this episode's coming out, we'll probably have some news about a security audit that was conducted at Home Assistant. Do you have any details there you can share with us at this point?
So the blog post is not out as we record this. We are still planning to, but because it might be delayed, I cannot like give all the details. But we've hired a company to do a security audit of Home Assistant, and they were focusing on our authentication stack, our web stack. At the same time, or like slightly after that, another security team did an audit of Home Assistant. Now, they also found both parties found things, no authentication bypasses, so that's really good. Mainly ways to trick users. The reason we went for a paid audit, because like over the years we've been, you know, sometimes get security issues reported, we get people auditing Home Assistant, and sometimes, you know, like, but you don't know if they've covered everything. So we did a paid audit to make sure that we define the scope, and we know that they go through all the different parts of our authentication layer to make sure that it's audited and it's secure.
Are they looking at the Nabucasa services too in that audit?
Yes. So they looked at the remote end-to-end encrypted remote connection as well. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, because that was like the, in a way we wanted to have the whole stack of like how do people access Home Assistant from both Home Assistant Cloud, but also if you just expose a port on your router, both stacks are fully audited to the authentication core.
And sounds like there was a couple of things, but nothing too major. And most of that stuff's already been rolling out patch-wise?
Yes, yes. But we are, a bunch of the stuff was done this summer. The audit was done this summer, and the fixes have been rolling out in the last couple of months. So if you've been keeping up to date, you should be good to go. If you've not been keeping up to date, you could get tricked, I guess, right? But it's not like they can just like go to Shodan, find Home Assistant instances and like hack.
Good. Well, that's good. Yeah. Now, are you planning to publish some aspects of the report, all of the report or anything like that at some point?
Yeah. So we're doing a whole every we have requested CVEs. Everything is on our security tab on the Home Assistant core repository, which is basically our, this is the place now where we track all the security issues. We're also going to, we've updated our security page where we just got to publish a timeline, and we want to make it more normal for our community that, hey, security issues happen. We're public about it. We're open about it. And here you can find them and just have this be more a day-to-day business. Like, oh, look, there's a new security issue. We fixed it. Please update your stuff. Because, you know, if you are like an enterprise or a business and you buy software and sometimes you get the security updates, you just update and you kind of go with your day. Users are just not used to that process as much, that their software has leaks and these kind of things. So we kind of have to educate them in that sense of like, hey, security issues happen everywhere and it's okay. We solve them. And as long as we, you know, are on top of it, we're probably in a good spot.
Yeah. It's almost impossible, right? I mean, humans make the software. It's a very, very, very sophisticated piece of software. I like the peace of mind of knowing that you guys are on top of it and you're doing the audit thing. Paulus, you know, I got to admit, at the beginning of the year, when I think I was watching the stream when you announced the year of voice, I thought, that's a long shot. I thought, well, okay, we'll see what we get. And now here we are, and it's not even the end of the year. And
yeah.
I am thrilled.
Yes. I think that what really helped is that, like, you know, the things that have come out, some of it was kind of already in the pipeline, like Piper, like Mike was working on it already. But things like Whisper, we didn't know that Whisper came out of OpenAI, right? And OpenAI created Whisper because there was not enough text for them to train ChatGPT on. So they're like, we need more text. Like, let's start transcribing audio and train on that. And then they made it open source because I don't know exactly why, but it's great for us. And so Open Wake Word as well, right? Like, David found that model and all of a sudden realized that with Piper and all these pieces falling into place.
Yeah. And, you know, the Atom Echo, it's not amazing, but it's a $13 little piece of hardware I can use to play around with this. That's pretty great.
Yeah, right now it's sold out everywhere, but by the end of October, there should be like 3,000 more, M5 Stack told us, and then they're going to make a bunch more. We're also going to talk to them because right now you can buy these $13 devices and then you have to go to our website. And we have this installer, browser-based installer for ESP devices. It installs the software on the device. But we're actually talking to M5 Stack, like, hey, can we just put the voice assistant firmware on it? Because nobody else uses these devices, really, right? Like, this is mainly used for Home Assistant. So let's get it working out of the box.
Yeah.
And so they are looking into that.
That'd be so great. In the RV, I think I'm going to use the motion detection, the presence detection for this trick. I'm not kidding. I'm going to put them in my storage bays. I'm going to have these little things everywhere outside in the yard so I can control the lights outside. So let's get it easy because I'm going to be doing a lot of these.
Nice.
Well, Paulus, just would you please pass our congratulations on to the team?
I will.
And our gratitude. I think this thing is going to be a real fire when people really start to figure it out and start playing with it and start building their own devices. I think it's just going to be a massive hit and just really excited to see where it goes now that, you know, we're at chapter four. So keep us posted and come back in the near future and give us an update on it, would you?
Yeah, definitely. Will do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Last episode, I asked for some feedback on a bunch of Nextcloud things, which we'll get to. But first, Ben wrote in. He says, the one thing keeping me from deleting my Plex container was the fantastic Plex amp for my music, as none of the Jellyfin alternatives I tried were anywhere near as good. Recently, however, I discovered the brilliant Symphonium Android app. You can use a Jellyfin music library as the back end, and it's incredibly customizable. Well worth a look. Cheers, and keep up the good work.
It does look like a really good app, actually. Put a link to this in the show notes, boys, because this is one of the number one things we hear about the Plex switch. I'd love to switch to Jellyfin, but I'm sticking with Plex because of Plex Amp. So Symphonium, and you can find it in the Play Store, it looks like. Boom. Link in the show notes for those of you listening. Thank you, Ben, for that information. If I've heard of that before, I had completely forgot about it. So appreciate that. And speaking of feedback, we got a bunch of great boosts this week. We're going to try to answer a bigger batch because there's been a lot of good questions. VT52 is our baller this week with 110,621 sats.
Oh, impressive.
And he's got two interesting devices to share with the class. And he says they're attractive and hackable. All right.
You're on the right show for that.
One is the Zima board, Z-I-M-A board. Around $120 to $200. It has 2 to 4 Celerons in there. It can go up to 8 gigs of RAM, 32 gigabyte eMMC, 6 watt TDP, 2 SATA connectors, 2 gigabit Ethernet, 2 USB 3, a PCIe 2.0 slot. 4 PCIe 2.0 slots. They're just 1X. It's got a mini DisplayPort and QuickSync. He also mentions it's passively cooled. And then the other one, and I have seen this one before, is the Zima Blade, which is bare bones at $64. Same specs as above, but only one SODIMM and only 1 gigabit Ethernet, only one, you know, fewer ports and stuff like that. It's ZimaBoard.com. I'm going to put a link to that in the notes too.
It seems like there are so many options these days for these boards. Like if I, they mostly get given to me, which is quite a wonderful position to be in. So thank you everyone for that. But if I had to choose one, I don't even, like, how do you choose? There's so many.
I've seen this one mentioned before on the show because it's like you look at it, it looks like it's designed to go in a car or a van. It's got like it looks like a ECU almost for a car, only, you know, way more expensive. And I'm curious to know how often they update this, because I have been looking at this with a curious eye since their Kickstarter about 302 years ago. And the question is it a one-time run or they keep revving it? If you know, please boost in. But VT wanted to continue talking about Auth. He says, I've searched, but I've only found internet arguments instead of solid advice. I don't know if I'm missing something. It seems to be like a really fragmented space. There's a service that supports LDAP. This one is HTTP Basic. The other one might be OIDC. It's all kind of just weird to me. Each is a snowflake requiring special config. Is this my life now? I'm usually currently using Kingdom OAuth 2 proxy and traffic. He says if we convert the boost amount, we get hex, which comes out as 16D8D if my math is right. But I don't know what it means. LDAP ultimately is the mother authentication backend. All things collapse to LDAP. Marquis comes in with 60,770 sats. Thank you. Using Podverse. First time booster here. Your show is everything I've been looking for, and I love it. Here's some sats to you on the topic of small home servers. I bought myself a Zima board, and it's amazing. It has an X64 Intel with two RJ45 PCI and PCIe slots and two SATA 3 ports, all for $120. The top version has 16 gigs of RAM, if I remember right. That's all for now. Thanks for the show. You're the best.
Are they coordinating out there?
How about some real-time follow-up there? Thank you, Marquia. That's nice. And thank you for the boost. Self-hosting is life. Comes in with 50,001 sats. It's keeping that boost train rolling. Hey, guys, how about a deeper look at NVR software? I know you covered it before, but a lot has changed. I finally got fed up with Blue Iris, and I decided to give Frigate a go, and I haven't looked back. Would love to hear an updated take from the two of you. Well, Jeff has been working with Frigate, and you've gone with the CPU for a while, and you just recently put like one of those corals in there to get accelerated recognition. Sounds like you're liking it with some caveats.
With some caveats. It seems plenty fast, and there's one big caveat, the hardware. It's an Intel Atom. It's a Bay Trail Intel Atom, and it's got a whopping 4 gigs of RAM.
So that's going to be a bottleneck.
It's going to be a big bottleneck. It did fine, actually, to recognize people. The inference time was about 1,200 milliseconds if people have used Frigate. It's really slow, but it seemed real stable. It seemed to find people every day. I just had to look the next day to see, you know, people, right? Which is okay.
Not quite what you're looking for.
Right. So I did put the TPU in there, and the inference time was way faster, about 10 to 12 milliseconds. And it seemed to work really, really well. But ever since then, it just hasn't been stable. I've got to reboot it every other day to make it do the detection again. And that's my fault. I guarantee it's my fault. I'm running the stupid thing on Arch. That's my fault. But hey, It's just to play with it. I am also fed up with the various NVR solutions, and so far, Frigate is my favorite on Linux. So I'll re-ramp that onto something better, something more stable, and give it another go. But for now, I'm loving it, and the TPUs are dirt cheap, and they work really well.
We were looking, and I do see success stories, too, of folks using Wyze cams with Wyze Bridge into Frigate. So I'm giving it a contemplation. I have Shinobi that I turn on from time to time, kind of when I'm like AFK, AFRV. And I think maybe Frigate would be a better solution for that. So self-hosting is life. Let us know if you keep playing with it, and I'm going to keep following Jeff's progress. Bronzenwing comes in with 50,000 sats using Fountain. They're going to switch to Albi and Castomatic. Nice. That's a great setup. They're passing on some sats. I want to say thanks for turning them on to Tailscale. I recently set it up with pfSense and HAProxy with the VPN on demand feature. It has, I have it advertise my local subnet and then advertise my local virtual IP for my internal reverse proxy and my local services domain. Now when I leave the house, it's like I never left. I can access my local services with their fully qualified domain names, but they aren't exposed to the internet.
It's magic. It's just pure magic.
Well done. Well done. So they have pfSense with HAProxy and the VPN on-demand feature, and they have it advertise their local subnet and then advertise their local virtual IP to their internal reverse proxy and their local services domain. That's a slick setup. That is a slick setup. Very impressed. Thank you for the boost. Darylman comes in with 10,000 statues in Podverse. Okay, so Plex, I'm responsible for the infra of about a million plus user app, and I'm also a self-hoster. They're right. It doesn't matter if it's a professional or a hobby. My main takeaway after 20 years in the area, just stick to plain open source. I keep my fingers off the closed source or pseudo open source software. Mid to long term, it always hurts to use it. Long live Jellyfin and all the others.
I redid the math on that number there, Chris.
Oh, on my hex?
No, on this one with many, many zeros here.
I think
that's actually 100 million users.
Oh, that's a lot of zeros.
That's a lot of zeros. Well, it says plus. So
what app
somewhere
could that
there.
Be? What app? That's
it reduces the list somewhat.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's some great feedback. And it echoes, I think, our sentiments as well. It's definitely true. And it kind of my philosophy for why I'm using the ESP hardware with relays you can get off Amazon and ESP Home. Maybe it's not quite as polished as the commercial solution. It requires a little bit more of Jeff's work, but it's going to last forever and it's super replaceable.
Well, and I feel like, you buried this thing in your wall. Hopefully you're allowed to forget about it in the sense that it's there for many, many years. It just keeps working.
Works like hardware.
Let's say 7 years from now, it just kind of gives out. Well, I think there would be enough resources out there for you to even solve the problem, even if, ESPs are probably long gone by then.
But relays are relays.
Uh-huh, exactly,
and,
right?
Yeah, yep. So and you just need to trigger that relay. Yeah, yeah. Gene Bean comes in with a row of ducks. Brent, answering your question from last week, I'm using the Nextcloud Snap today, but I want to get away from it. I'm considering trying the Nextcloud Pi after talking to a community member about it, but I'm still undecided. And I'm interested in what others have to say. That's a tough question because I want to loop it in with Andre2K. I think they're related. He sent in 6,666 sats. So thank you, Gene. And here, Andre's kind of along your same kind of line of thinking. He says, I'm using Nextcloud from Linux Server IO. I had to migrate from MariaDB to Postgres because of newer versions not working out about a year ago. I've been thinking about switching to the all-in-one Docker to get hardware support for Recognize. But I didn't like the setup of the container since it was so different from other containers. And so this is a question I think a lot of people that are dipping their toe into Nextcloud, maybe taking their Nextcloud setup I want to test it to the actually want to use it stage. Jeff's been fighting with his Nextcloud setup. He's got kind of like a basic container setup, right? I think are you using the Linux Server IO image?
No, I don't believe so.
But you are on the old MariaDB.
Yes.
And the question you've been having recently, is it worth tearing down that DB, moving to the new stuff and going with just a straight up container? Or is it worth doing the all-in-one?
Right.
And having it kind of manage all that stuff.
Right. Yeah. Getting help setting it up, the way it is now with the reverse proxy. It's above my head. I don't fully understand it and I need to fully understand this. And if I don't fully understand it, it needs to manage itself. So the all-in-one kind of seems like a good deal, but not too sure. I'm in the same boat.
I think it kind of depends on how solid their implementation is of all of it. Like I was saying before, off air, I kind of look at it from a repairability standpoint. And the simpler the setup is, the easier it is to repair once you do understand it. And it's kind of like a new car that's totally sealed up that you can't really repair and do work on versus an older car that the engine bay has tons of room and you know what everything does. And you can actually trace one thing to another thing and go, oh, that's probably this and fix it. If you just go simple and stand up a database container and a Nextcloud container and then put Nginx in front of that to do reverse proxy, you could use traffic if you want, but just keep it really simple. You will be able to open the configs in all three of those cases and understand what they're doing, but you'll never understand what the all-in-one setup is doing. So I think there's that consideration. Now, if it doesn't break and it doesn't really have any other downsides, maybe that's fine, right? I mean, Volvo tells me that my four-wheel drive system never needs maintenance. But then, of course, I got 100,000 miles into it and it turns out, oh, we were wrong. It actually does have a fundamental problem and you have to fix that. And to fix that, you have to take the whole thing apart. But, of course, it was never designed to be taken apart. And so now I just have something that's kind of a time bomb possibly. And I don't like that. It's sort of the same implication you have with those other whole home server out of a box systems. I think the real approach is simplicity. Now, Eric sent in a row of ducks to let us know that he has been very happy using Nix to set up Nextcloud and Postgres, and he also has a Flake that does it. And the nice thing there is that's a whole other level of one place to read it and you understand what it does. After the show, I'll show you my Nextcloud Nginx config in Nix, and you'll read that and go, oh, yeah, I know exactly what that's doing. And that kind of, to me, is like how you make it approachable to repair. So I don't know if I like the Pi image, and I don't know if I like the all-in-one as much, but I'm open to the ideas. But traditionally, my experience has always been when I use one of these types of all-in-one solutions, I inevitably, if I want to put it in production seriously, end up tearing all that down and just going building the essential system.
I feel like, though, some of these projects are trying to aim at, you know, different types of users.
Yeah.
Because that advice is super sound for someone who at least wants to get their feet wet in those technologies, which I think is likely most of us here listening to this. But just reading the Pi documentation, for instance, it's clear that they're trying to build something that is kind of literally all in one. Like it has backups in there and has everything. And I know the all in one container is attempting to do that, but I think it also reaches for a different audience. And so it's.
Are you.
It might be similar to me in the sense that, you know, 5 years ago I installed the Snap because it was as much as I could bear back then.
Right.
But as you grow, you move into new solutions.
Yep.
So it's a tricky problem.
Yeah. And I think Jeff and probably a lot of the listeners that boosted in are kind of in this spot where you're kind of deciding, do I want to go all in and learn it this way? Do I want to go all in and learn it this way? And it's so you're really kind of, you're almost looking at, do you want an iPhone? Do you want an Android? Do you want a Mercedes? Do you want an old Toyota? Like you're kind of making a similar type of decision. And ultimately, I think like maybe you're actually an old Toyota guy because you like, you know, these old 80s Toyotas are super repairable. But, you know, the new ones are really sweet and they got that auto driving feature and they're half hybrid. And that's really, and that kind of draws you in and you get into it a couple of years and you're like, oh, crap, I can't do anything with this. I don't know. It could be a bad analogy, but I think that's kind of where I think Gene Bean and Andre are kind of sliding. I don't know about Jeff, but perhaps too. Megastrike came in with 5,011 sats and one, I think this is our last Nextcloud, maybe. But was asking about using it on a VPS to host. And if we don't use it on a VPS, do we use it on systems that have ECC memory? They want to get it on their LAN, but they want to do it right the first time. Now, take note of this one, Jeff. They said in the past, they did run the Nextcloud all-in-one setup, but they say it was slow to release and they had one breaking update, but it was pretty bad.
Well, every update breaks for me, so still one to consider.
Megastrike, thank you for the boost. No, I don't follow very carefully on the ECC stuff. I just load it on the system, and I don't really think about the RAM. I mean, I do prefer it on server-grade hardware in general, and I would totally take ACC if I could, but it's not a hard requirement. Not at all. Not even, like, a little bit. But not a bad thing to think of if you can afford it.
It feels to me like part of the success for pieces of software like Nextcloud and Home Assistant really is there flexibility, if you will, flexibility in hardware. You know, you can run it in so many different places and so much different type of hardware, from little tiny single boards to like some really bigger stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It feels to me like there's a trade-off there, because you get a bunch of users who would otherwise never get their feet wet in these technologies. But as people grow, especially into careers or whatever, and they use more sophisticated technologies, then the software can grow with them, which is actually kind of cool.
It is good, but it leads to kind of confusion as to which path that should be taken.
It's true. Yeah, and I wonder if those projects can have more clarity to guide users in that specific way. Because if I was new to Nextcloud, this is really what I'm trying to solve is like, where do you go?
The first red flag was probably years ago when the Linux Server IO version of Nextcloud container started getting popular. It was clear they were addressing a market need there. All right, here's our last boost, boys. We're going to wrap it up. But I think this one would be probably someone in the audience would be capable of answering. We'll see if we have any ideas, though. B2 Thread comes in at 10,000 sats using Fountain, and they write, I was trying to save my sats to do a zip code boost, but I'm beating my head against the wall for a problem. I need some help. I'm trying to set up an HP Thin client with 16 gigs of flash on board. Mint XFCE is just too big. I'd like to throw something else on there and then just remote desktop connect into my Fedora desktop, which has a Ryzen and plenty of free resources. But I just can't seem to get them to talk. What should I put on the thin client to easily talk to Fedora? And what should I put on the box that could easily access it? Should I just hop distros and maybe go to Ubuntu on both? I don't know if I have a great answer. But I think you could probably easily find a Linux that is smaller than Linux Mint XFCE if you're just trying to get a Linux environment on that little thin client. Maybe even a minimal install of Fedora.
Something just came to mind. There are distros specifically for RDP, extremely small. They're built for thin clients. Try one of those?
Yeah. One thing that we were thinking about during our prep for the show that Jeff brought up is the one maybe advantage to doing the same distro on both ends would be that the server of the RDP server and the RDP client are probably going to pretty well match up in capabilities and features. Make sure you can actually connect B2. Make sure the internal GNOME RDP server is working, because if you're on an older version of GNOME by a couple of releases, you could just be running into some fundamental functionality problems. So do a, you know, get it running and then just launch Romania or even the Microsoft RDP client. But if you're on the local host, run Romania, something like that, and just do a local host connection in and see if that works. Verify your RDP is working. And then the idea with RDP is that it's the protocol and the clients are the display end. So you just got to find the appropriate client. I think Romania is a pretty good one. And it doesn't actually have to be the same OS, doesn't have to be even the same versions, but the closer you get, the less problems you'll have there. If anybody out there in the audience has some good experience with thin clients, you know, I'm talking actual thin clients and getting OSs on there and getting connected, let us know. This is a topic of mine that is one of my OG passions. One of the first big projects I had at scale was deploying Linux terminal services in libraries. And then later on, I ended up working on Microsoft terminal services. So I really love thin clients and I love the remote desktop stuff. So if anybody out there has some geekery to share, please boost in. If you'd like to boost in, you can get a new podcast app at podcastapps.com. And then you top it off and you just boost in. They got a button right there. Or if you want to keep your dang podcast app, I know you. I know you like your app. Just get Albie, getalbie.com, and then you can boost from the web. It's something like Podcast Index or Fountain FM. We'll have links in the notes. It's all on the Lightning Network. So you just top it off however you like, and you boost in. Now, we did get 22 total boosters. We couldn't fit everybody in because of the runtime, but we sure do appreciate and read all of them. And we stacked a grand total of 367,659 sats. Thank you, everybody who supports this production directly. And, of course, thank you to our SRE subscribers. You are our site reliability engineers. You can support the show directly with a monthly membership. You get an ad-free version of the show, and you get a post-show. And, of course, the warm fuzzies of keeping us going at selfhosted.show/SRE. Now, this, for us, is pre-Linux Fest. For most people listening, though, Linux Fest will have happened by the time they're listening to this, and all things open will have happened. So I imagine when we get together again, perhaps we'll have some stories to share. We'll get caught up with Alex. But I want to thank Paulus for coming on the show. It was really great to chat. I've been so thrilled with the progress of the Year of Voice. I have it set up everywhere here at the studio, and I have multiple pipelines. So one of the cool things you can do is you can have multiple assistants. And so I have local pipeline. I have like a slow one that I'm trying on the Raspberry Pis, and then I have the Nebucasa Cloud, Home Assistant Cloud pipeline. And not only that, but on Android, you can replace the Google Assistant with Home Assistant. And so you can trigger the assistant and it pulls up just Home Assistant.
What?
And then from there, even once the UI is up, you can even switch between your different Home Assistant servers. So I can switch between the studio and the RV for different voice commands.
That is so cool.
They really
and really it. Thoughtful, like a thoughtful integration.
It's been fun playing with the back end tech too. Just as much fun playing with the back end stuff. It's just been pretty great to see. I can only imagine what it's going to be in another year, because some of those people are working there full time now on this stuff. All right, that's it for us. Thank you so much for tuning in this week's episode. You can get the links to everything we talked about today at selfhosted.show/108. And, of course, you can email us at selfhosted.show/contact. You'll find the links to contact Alex and I and Brent and Jeff and all that stuff there as well. Thanks for listening. That was Self-Hosted 108. Right before we sat down to record the show today, we were all three geeking out about one of the servers we're working on. Well, I'll let Jeff get into some of the hardware that's in this thing, because it's pretty cool. But it has this PCI expansion card in it that has two SD card slots, traditional big SD card slots, and it is the OS drive. One is the OS And the other is a redundant, you can't use it. It's just like making a mirror copy. And you have to, you've put them both in there. You put them, it's each side of the PCI riser card has an SD card slot. You slide them both in there, and then you put it in the PCI slot. And that's the dang OS drive. And the irony is, and Jeff's going to tell you the specs of this thing, but the irony is, long story short, it's a hardware monster, right? But when you're installing the OS, you might as well be installing it on a Raspberry Pi because it's going to an SD card and it's not using like both of them for read-write performance. So it's just like this monster of a machine that is limited by the SD card. So the OS installation experience, oh, it feels like you're on a, like a small board computer.
It feels though, Chris, like you could have really used this for your Pis in the past.
Yeah.
That's your main gripe with them. Boy, right?
You know, if the Pi 5... could have just put a little RAID chip on there. You know, I'm not asking for much, you know, put a little extra SD card slot on there. You know what I'm saying? I mean, if they're not going to give me an eMMC. So do you remember the specs of this monster, Jeff?
Oh, yeah, I got them right here. So this thing we're working on, it has four Xeon E5-4657L processors. These are 12-core with hyper-threading. That's 96 usable threads.
Oh.
And the RAM, though it's DDR3, it's clocked a bit high at 1866 megahertz, and it's got 384 gigs of it.
Yeah.
That's like, that's more RAM space than I think I have free space on any of my drives combined at home.
Yeah.
Or in my cabin, I should say.
And then we've got some disks in the slots. And do you remember how many?
Yep. There are 8 4-terabyte. They are the Barracudas, so likely 5,400 RPM. I couldn't find the speed on them. And then there are 8 2-terabyte, 7,200 RPM drives from Dell.
Yeah. And that's where our VMs, or we'll slice those up and probably get some redundancy out of it and then put our VMs on that. And that'll be our, and right before we sealed it all up, we slipped a little GTX 1050 in there too. Mm-hmm. So we'll have, nothing, not incredible, but we'll have some CUDA cores in this thing too.
Barely fit, but we made it work.
So
what are your intentions with this thing?
Well, one of the things you need to train the Home Assistant wake word model is you kind of need CUDA. And I guess the Google Collab thing's doing CUDA, I guess. But we tried to run it in our Python environment. The CUDA stuff died on us. But you could do a little Proxmox PCI pass through to a NIX box that's ready to go to build this kind of stuff. And we could start generating our models for the wake word with a lot more iterations and a lot more accuracy. Because when you use the free demo that they have, when you crank up the iterations and stuff, it times out. It's like you're doing it on a 486. Yeah. It's horrible. I mean, it's free, so it's great, but it's not really but very much of a machine because they don't want people abusing it. But if you could run that locally, just let it go for a while. 96 cores and some CUDA cores in there and some RAM. It could just cook for a bit and you come back in the morning, it's all done.
Do you have any wager on whether the GPU or the CPU will outperform the other?
I actually wouldn't be surprised. If you could do the work on the CPU, I wouldn't be surprised. But the Python environment they have doesn't offer a CPU version.
Oh, I see why you were so motivated to squeeze this thing in.
Yeah,
then.
It's only CUDA.
Oh, man.
At least right now.
Yeah, and just curious about the specs of that. I'm not too privy on these CUDA devices, but 640 CUDA cores on a 1050. It's a low-end card. It doesn't even have like a PCI power plug. It's all
just internal. Taking power off the PCI bus. It doesn't need an external. I'm sure like the new NVIDIA ones are like 3,000 plus CUDA cores.
Oh, more than likely. Yeah. But, either way, something there is going to be better than nothing.
It means the scripts will run. And if it takes time, that's okay. You know, because it's not like we're paying for the time. Well, we're paying for the power, but we're not paying for like cloud time to run it. And it'll do a lot. This box will do a lot of other things, but being able to pass through one NVIDIA GPU to one VM, because we don't have really NVIDIA GPUs anywhere else anymore. They're all kind of either been replaced with AMD or Intel. So to have access on demand to one CUDA machine is going to be really great.
And one thing that just popped in my head, I'm not sure if NVIDIA is going to allow us in their driver. I know there's been issues, but there are workarounds. I've seen workarounds specifically for like Proxmox and others. So yeah, that's going to be a Wes problem for sure.
It's going to be an Alex or a Wes problem. One of them will figure it out.
I'm curious what you think about these SD cards. Because I think the workload, whatever workload this thing was doing in its previous life, that was just fine. But that seems like a real challenge.
You know,
any workarounds?
The trick's going to be, I was just thinking, the trick's going to be how much logging and whatnot Proxmox does to the root file system. Because the way that Dell, I think, made this work originally is it was a tiny little slice of the SD card, and I don't think it was doing much. They probably had it configured to just sort of run launch and then everything either runs in memory or runs on the array.
I feel like you just run the entire thing in RAM disk.
Hmm. You know, yeah, you don't really have that limitation. Do we still have a PCI slot available, or do we burn it?
I believe there's one available on the other side.
Because we do have that PCI to NVMe adapter.
Right.
That we could throw in there.
Didn't even notice. We had all the I think there's four sockets available, and we used two of them for the.
So we could, if the SD cards end up being a problem, we could switch over to that as a solution. We'll see. Ideally, right, the SD cards are just the Proxmox install. And then all of the stuff we care about is on the RAID array.
Yeah, but I feel like a Proxmox install won't be a read only, right?
Yeah, no, it's gonna. Yeah, we'll see. Maybe somebody out there knows. Let us know. Does it burn up your SD card?
Clearly, I feel like we're walking towards the precipice, and or know, someone has to. Keep
we're gonna
us
just
from
do
jumping.
It, and then people will find out when we find out.
Oh gosh.